This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. So once again, we're interviewing George Werthner, outdoorsman, author, photographer, writer. He sits on the boards of several environmental and wildlife organizations, and he just completed an adventurous trip on the Ivishock River on the north slope of Alaska. So welcome, George, and tell me about the wildlife that you saw on the Ivishock River.
Well, surprisingly, it was pretty limited. And what we heard, you know, so I told you in the previous episode that I flew from the village, Arctic Village, to the put-in for the river trip. Now, I don't know, we flew at least, probably across at least 100 miles of the Brooks Range getting there, and we didn't see a single Dall sheep. We didn't see any other wildlife either during that whole thing, and that's pretty amazing, and we're flying low. I mean, we're flying through passes and stuff like where the mountainsides are on either side of the plane. So if there was something there, particularly Dall sheep, which are white, you'd notice them. And talking to, well, I talked to this native guy in Arctic Village who said that the Dall sheep population had crashed around Arctic Village. All the places he used to hunt in the old days, there are no Dall sheep left. And we had a similar report. We stopped it at the Fish and Game Office, Alaska Fish and Game Office, before the trip in Fairbanks, and they told us a similar thing. And their theory, there are several things they point to. One could be just overhunting, could be affecting the herds there, because they're, you know, the Brooks Range is low productivity and really harsh conditions. I mean, the wintertime, it's dark 24 hours a day. So you're a Dall sheep trying to get by, and the temperature may be 50 below zero. It's a tough experience. So they have lower productivity than other parts of Alaska. And the other thing that's happening is climate change. And they've had a number of years now where normally, as I said, it'd be very cold in the Brooks Range in the winter, but they've had a few episodes of warming temperatures that warmed up enough to sort of melt the snow, and then it gets cold again and gets refrozen. And the snow then is hard, and it's hard for the sheep to paw through to get at the grass beneath it, which is what they feed on in the winter. Uh-huh. And so that's one theory for the decline. And, you know, it's not that so many of the sheep starved themselves, which some undoubtedly did, but the young lambs would be born weak because the mothers lacked nutrition, and they would often die before they got any, you know, to any age. And, you know, you have that happen a number of years, and pretty soon you're losing a lot of the sheep. But we also didn't see any wolf tracks. We didn't see any moose tracks. We saw some caribou tracks, and we saw lots of digging up by grizzly bears where they go after these roots in the tundra, and they flip over the tundra and eat the roots. And there was a whole lot of that all around where we were camping every night. But didn't see an actual bear on the trip. I saw altogether 5 caribou the whole time we were floating the river. And so that wasn't very much there either. So it was really depopulated. And again, I don't know why. I mean, caribou are migratory, and we didn't hit the migration, so that could be part of it. The other thing that was surprising, though, was there was very little fish in the river, too. In fact, a couple of the guys on the trip, not me, but a couple of the other guys that went, had brought less food than they thought they would need, counting on being able to catch fish. And we only caught a few grayling the whole trip. The river has only Arctic char and grayling, but the Arctic char are migratory. They're like salmon. They come up from the Arctic Ocean, but we got there too early for that. And the grayling were not very abundant. And I think it's partly, as I mentioned, this river has basically no fish habitat. It just races towards the Arctic Ocean. There's some deep pools and stuff, but there's nothing in the deep pools for a fish to hide behind. No big boulders, no logs or anything like that. So it really was surprising how few fish we saw. And then birds, well, we saw some birds. The neatest ones for me was we went right below a cliff that had a peregrine falcon nest, and the peregrines were diving on us, which is cool. But we did not see very many birds. We saw, you know, it's funny, there's robins way up north. That always surprises me because I think of them as, you know, the kind of thing you see in your yard in Bozeman or something like that. And, but they are north of the Arctic Divide. Say's phoebe is another one that kind of surprised me because that's an insectivore. And then there were, you know, as we got close to the Arctic Ocean, there were some gulls. There were some water birds like mergansers and a few others on the river, but not much even in the way of birds. It was a really surprising thing. And this is a point that people should appreciate in Montana, is that I think wildlife viewing is way better in Montana. There's way more, you see tracks, you see more evidence. You know, the birch range is so far north, it's low productivity. It can't support very many grizzly bears. It can't support very many, you know, doll sheep or whatever compared to, for the same size area that you would have in Montana. So in a way, this being in the Rockies, if you like looking at wildlife, is way better thing than way up north in the birch range. And it's always been that way. You know, like I said, I was up on the Kobuk River in 1973 in the birch range, and I happened to hit a caribou migration when I was there, which was kind of cool. I saw about 10,000 caribou go by me, but, and the same thing when I was working in the Gates of the Arctic and so forth. It was, you know, really unusual to see wildlife, although I did see in my tramps around there, this would have been in the early 80s, I did see, you know, doll sheep pretty regularly. I saw, you know, moose on occasion, caribou, at least during the migration. See, the caribou, they calve out on the coastal plain. And partly to get away from insects, and partly the strategy is they all calve at the same time. And then wolves can only kill a few of the young, and then they keep moving, and then the wolves can't keep up with them because they have to bring their food back to their dens. So the strategy is, you know, calve on the coastal plain, then they, when the snow or the colder weather starts, they move to the south of the Brooks Range, where there are trees, and they feed primarily on lichens on the ground as well as the lichens on the trees in the wintertime there. And it's cold, but it's not that windy usually in the interior. That's where they try to winter. And so these migrations that, you know, you've probably heard about the concern in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge about drilling in the coastal plain would interrupt caribou migrations. And the same thing was a concern about the proposed Ambler Road that would go across to mining claims in the Blard Mountains in the Western Brooks Range. That was going to be a 211-mile-long road, which the BLM just rejected. And, you know, of course, there'll be lawsuits. Who knows if they'll get it. But anyway, that road, was one of the concerns, was also interfering with the migration of the caribou when they try to move south of the Brooks Range.
Do you think that getting back to the doll sheep, do you think that they have changed their habitat, or is their population just diminished?
You know, I just don't know enough about it. I was just surprised when I heard from the Fish and Game that they declined. And then, like I said, this older native guy I talked to in Arctic Village confirmed what the Fish and Game had told us, and then my own eyes confirmed it. We did see one muskox, by the way. They're found north on the coastal plain. They're herds. I saw them on the Canning River, too, when I floated that. But they're not found south of the Brooks Range. You only find them on the northern slope there and on the coastal plain. But, you know, it's just a really extreme location. And you just don't see – I saw some ptarmigan. That was another thing, but not a lot. It was, if I had been trying to survive on, you know, fish and game, I'd probably be on the starving end of stuff. So I spent a lot of time and knew all the nooks and crannies of where to go. So,
what kind of forage is there for the caribou and the doll sheep up in that tundra?
Well, the doll sheep are primarily grass, and then the mountain slopes are drier, usually because they're better drained and the grass does well there. And then the valleys are more of this wet tundra, which is a hell of a thing to walk across. And it has lichens and stuff in the wet tundra, and the caribou will feed on those lichens. They're primary lichens and shrub. They'll feed on shrubs as well, like willow and so forth. But And the moose, of course, are big feeders on willow. And moose are now found north of the Birch Range, which they were not 100 years ago. They did not exist there. In fact, the Eskimo or Inuit name for moose is big caribou, because they didn't have another way to describe it, because they were such recent immigrants, you might say, colonizers of that habitat. And with the climate warming that's happening, one of the things that I noticed when I years ago, I hiked up the Anituvik River. This is in the early 70s. And I went back in, I don't know, 2000 and something. Anyway, the willows there, when I hiked it up in the 70s, were mostly like, you know, 2 feet high, 3 feet high. And I saw willows that were 20 feet high by in the 2000s when I was there. And that's, again, due to climate change. And the same with the balsam poplar populations that are popping up here and there north of the Brooks Range. They are, you know, they're tree related. They look like cottonwood, basically. But they're only found even now in the best sheltered locations, because they still are, you know, just colonizing the area, and they don't do that well in the really, where there's permafrost and too much, cold.
So you said you saw bear tracks, but you didn't see any bears. Is that right?
Yeah, we saw where the bears had dug up these roots, and that's something they tend to feed on earlier in the season. They're a legume, a pea family thing. It has a big root that they dig up, and then later on they're feeding more on berries. But that was another thing. We hardly saw any blueberries in bloom. They're pretty scarce. But that they turned to that buffalo berries and a few other berries, and you know, they don't have much in the way of meat to eat. I mean, they might get lucky and get a caribou calf or whatever, but that didn't happen very often. And so they're mostly vegetarian up there, and the vegetation is pretty limited. They don't eat things like willows, so which is probably the most abundant plant, at least along the river channels. But they're eating these roots and berries, and you know, roots and berries don't grow big bears.
Were you bothered by any mosquitoes?
Well, it depends. You know, I've spent, this was my 26th or 27th trip to Alaska. So I've spent a lot of time in the Alaska bush. And to my mind, it wasn't very bad at all. I didn't even put on any bug spray the whole time. But my companions, some of whom hadn't spent much time up in the Arctic, thought they were pretty bad, but you know, it's all kind of a relative thing. I did a backpack trip one time in June. This is when I left out of Arctic Village to the Arctic Divide, and the mosquitoes were so thick on that trip. You know, it's the sun's up the whole time. It's the longest days of the year. The mosquitoes really do well. I mean, my pants, which were green, would look gray because there were so many mosquitoes on it, and I could grab, like, take my hand and scoop up some of the mosquitoes, and one handful I did enough to make like a snowball of mosquito bodies. And then it drives you crazy. They're all around your face. I had to set up my tent every day just to eat my lunch. One time I'm walking along there and they were just following me, and I decided I'm going to run away from these guys. So I ran away maybe 100 feet, and I could see the outline of my body in mosquitoes. coalesce into one big ball and come directly after me, you know. So it was like, you can't get away from these guys. You know, they're out there, and they know they got a good thing. Again, you got to think, well, what are they eating when they don't have a human there? Well, there's some caribou, and there's not a lot of other things for them to get their blood from, you know, birds and so forth, small birds like ptarmigan maybe, or whatever. That was another thing. We saw a few ground squirrels, but hardly any of them even. So, you know, there's not a lot for even mosquitoes to eat up there.
Yeah, right.
But there sure seem to be a lot of them trying to do it.
Is the region threatened by any human activities where you
were? Well, they are, yeah, not where we were per se, because the area is part of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, 19 million acre area. To just give a size comparison, the state of Maine is 20 million acres. So the Arctic Wildlife Refuge just alone is about the size of the state of Maine. But there have been proposals for years to drill on the coastal plain of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And this is something that the Trump administration made a decision to allow drilling there. And, of course, it was challenged in court, and it hasn't happened yet. But they know that there's oil there because the native people back in the 70s got land allotments throughout Alaska, and they were nobody's fool. They picked places where there was oil or minerals or whatever. So some of the oil companies did exploration on some of their plots with private lands within the refuge, which the refuge cannot do anything to stop. And they are pretty confident that there's oil there. And so this has been a debate for decades and decades, and efforts to try to, a lot of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is designated wilderness, which, as you know, does not allow roads or other development, but not the whole thing. And the coastal plain section, I think it's about 3 million acres or something, is still not wilderness. And so they could potentially drill for oil there. And what has happened, there's a little Alaskan history that's interesting. When Prudhoe Bay was discovered in the late 60s, it was the, it was the 10th largest oil deposit known in the world at the time. The other nine were in Saudi Arabia. So that's why it could justify the construction of the Alaska pipeline, because it was a very big oil deposit. But nevertheless, after, after almost 50 years of drilling and taking the oil out, the oil supplies in those areas are declining, and they have less and less oil to ship in the pipeline. So they're constantly looking for new areas to exploit. And one of the areas is in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. The other is in the Alaska Naval Petroleum Reserve, which was set aside also back in the early 1900s. And there's been a lot of back and forth on that. The Biden administration put about 11 million acres. That place is 23 million acres. About half of it off limits to oil drilling. But the Trump administration had leased part of it, and the leases are legal contracts. So you can't, if the oil companies want to drill there, they can, unless somehow the leases are nullified. And I don't know enough about the legality of doing that. But in any event, they're spreading out from Prudhoe Bay east and west, and have been doing so for a long time, because they got the basic infrastructure there. You know, Prudhoe Bay is a big town. They've got, you can get daily jet planes to Fairbanks or Anchorage, direct flights from Prudhoe, and they have, all the equipment there and so forth. So they can tap into oil deposits east and west of Prudhoe Bay, and then run pipelines to the main pipeline to ship the oil south. So as long as oil prices stay high, then it makes sense for them to develop the oil there and go after what's there. And remember, it's geologically, it's just like the Rocky Mountain front. And if you go, there's oil wells along the Rocky Mountain front in Montana and a whole lot up in Alberta. It's the same geological formation. And in fact, the Williston geological formation in North Dakota is just the other part of that where it comes up to the surface from the Rocky Mountains. And so that whole geological area has oil under it. Whether it's worth drilling for it is a question, because the costs up in Alaska are much higher than if you were drilling for oil in Williston, North Dakota, or Texas or whatever, because your workers get paid more, the equipment is harder to run. Like airplanes in the wintertime, you can have the engine blocks crack and stuff when it's 50 below and you're trying to fly. So it's more dangerous to operate up there, and so it really has to be higher-priced oil to justify it.
All right. So the Evishak River flows down to the Sagavanirtok River.
Yep.
Then what happens?
Well, that river goes out to the Arctic Ocean near Prudhoe Bay, and that was the final river. We were on that river for a short ways before we were able to hike out to the Pipeline Haul Road.
You know, I looked it up on the Google, look up a Google map, and it showed a dry river flowing from that junction with the Evishak and Sagavanirtok River down to Prudhoe Bay. Why does it show a dry river on the Google map?
Well, it's a riverbed that when the river's flooding has water in it. Like when we got there, it didn't have water in it. So we had to keep going down that river till we found a spot where one of the channels went over to the west as far as it went, in fact, to that dry riverbed that you saw on Google, and water was in it for a ways, and that's where we pulled out.
Oh, I see. So you—that's where you took out, and you took out on what side of the river?
On the very western side of the river, right. And then we had it wasn't very far, about half a mile to walk out to the Pipeline Haul Road, and we camped there next to the road, and we got there the night before because I was very concerned about being there. The van was going to show up at 9 a.m, and had we not gotten to that spot, like I said, the van was only going to wait 15 minutes. If we weren't there, goodbye, van. And then the next van wouldn't be for another 4 days, I think, was the next one we'd come along. And then we'd still have to pay for the one we didn't get on because we were the only people on that van. And so, anyway, so it would have been a lot more expensive.
So that van took you down to Prudhoe Bay, is that it?
No, the van took us the other way, all the way back to Fairbanks. And that was a really cool ride. I had, years ago, again, driven up the Pipeline Haul Road and did some hikes off of it into the Gates of the Arctic National Park, because the Gates of the Arctic National Park actually comes right down to the Haul Road in places, the boundary. But I hadn't been up over the Arctic Divide, and on the stretch it goes the rest of the way to Prudhoe. So I got to see that part of the Brooks Range there. And this is a really cool thing to think about. As much as, I would have liked no Pipeline Haul Road or oil development there years ago when it was first being proposed, that's the only road. So, going east from that Pipeline Haul Road, the next road that you can travel up is the Dempster Highway in the Yukon. That's probably about 500 miles to the east. And if you go west from the Pipeline Haul Road, you go all the way to the Bering Sea without any roads. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of miles. And so that's one of the great things about the Brooks Range. And most of it is protected now in one way or another as a wildlife refuge or a national park. And I always like to tell this story to people. Back in the 1930s, Bob Marshall, who the Bob Marshall Wilderness in Montana is named for, mm-hmm. had written in one of his books a proposal to make the entire Brooks Range all the way down to the Yukon River be one giant national park. And of course, that didn't happen. It was considered kind of a crazy idea back in the 1930s. But if you look at a map today of the Brooks Range, well, areas north of the Yukon River, most of it is either national wildlife refuges or national parks. So you got the Arctic Wildlife Refuge on the east, and next you have the Gates of the Arctic, and then you have the Noatak Reserve and the Kobuk Valley National Park, and then south of that you have the Selowik Wildlife Refuge, the Kantai Wildlife Refuge, the Koyukuk Wildlife Refuge, the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge. And so, basically everything north of the Yukon River is now protected in one fashion or another. It's not all one national park, but it's and a lot of that, those areas are also designated wilderness on top of it. So they have a wilderness overlay, like the Gates of the Arctic is 8-point-something million acres. And most of that is designated wilderness, for example. Same with the Noatak, and the same with some of these wildlife refuges are primarily protected as wilderness. And the 11 million acres in the Naval Petroleum Reserve, which is on the north slope of the Brooks Range that Biden set aside, it doesn't have any special, it's not wilderness or anything yet, but hopefully that could happen eventually. And so you'd add to that whole large protected block of land from the Bering Sea all the way to the Yukon border. And on the Yukon side, there's a couple of national parks that border the Brooks Range area, border the U.S. So we have a huge, huge area that's basically a protected Arctic preserve.
So how long was the time it took to get from where you got on a van and got into Fairbanks?
It was a 13-hour drive, and that's because most of that road is just gravel, and the van could only travel about, and it winds around a lot too. It could only travel about 30 to maybe 40 miles an hour. We got into Fairbanks late at night, like 1 a.m, and my son and I just got dropped off at the airport because we were flying back to the lower 48 states. Our plane was leaving at 7 a.m. So we just threw out our sleeping bags and slept on the floor there until things started moving around 5 a.m. So it was really, that was another amazing thing. here you are at the Fairbanks Airport, and 6 hours later, I was in Bend, Oregon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing, you know, that you can go through, you know, a huge transition like that overnight, you know. And, of course, in the old days, it was quite a bit of a trek to get to the Berkshire Range. You had to take a boat from Seattle, and then maybe you landed on the Bering Sea, or you landed at Valdez, and then you took maybe a dog sled in the winter, or a sleigh run by horses to Fairbanks. And then you had to line up the rivers to get into the Berkshire Range. When Bob Marshall was up there exploring around, it was no easy trip to get into the Berkshire Range. And when I was a ranger in the Gates of the Arctic National Park, they were just writing the proposal for the management of the park. And one of the things that they allow there is planes to land in wilderness, which also happens like in the Bob Marshall and River Return wilderness and so forth. But I had proposed that the Park Service should start a new policy of no plane landings. And you would never need permits. You would never have too many people going into the Brooks Range if you had to line up the rivers to get even into the Brooks Range. So anyway, that didn't happen, of course. But it's not like the Brooks Range is overrun with people anyway. The year I worked in the Gates of the Arctic, once I was out in the backcountry, which was most of the summer, I only ran into three other people. So it's not like a heavily used. I mean, there are a few places like the Ergetch Peaks is a famous part of the Gates of the Arctic where a lot of people go to, and you know, and there's a fair number of people who hike out of the Anishinaabeg Pass village. But in general, you could be in valleys where you're never going to see anybody, even if you camp there all summer. So
George, did you accomplish the purpose that you set out to achieve when you decided to do this trip?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the main purposes was to get my son up to the Berkshire Range. We've done a number of other trips in Alaska. We were in Denali. We kayaked in Prince William Sound and so forth, but not that far north. So, yeah, I got him up there, and he got to see it, and he really loved it. And so I feel good that both my kids got to see the Brooks Range, which is my favorite part of Alaska, and that was the main thing. Plus, I got to go with my buddies that I've known for years from being in Montana, and so, you know, the social thing is great, and the landscape is really spectacular, and it's still, you know, a place where nature controls things, like the rain flooding the river. You know, too bad if your plants were to launch that day, you have to wait it out.
Well, George, it's been a marathon session, and I really thank you for telling us about it. Probably nobody who's listening to this will ever get up there, but that's great to hear your story about it. And thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Jay. I appreciate having the chance to talk about it.
Our guest today has been George Werthner, outdoorsman, author, photographer, and writer. And this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can see our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.